Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The town of Berlin has been named America's coolest small town. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. And this morning we're going to explore that title bestowed by budget travel. In addition, in the second half of the show, we will be talking with a reporter from the Daily Times about its series on the future of Salisbury. But first to the town of Berlin, which has been a site of a number of films, including The Runaway Bride. Budget travel notes the town is not far from Ocean City and Assateague Island, while its downtown historic district is on the National Register. In addition, the town hosts a number of events, but it's only a town of 4,500 people. But it is known far beyond the Eastern Shore. And in our studio, to take a look at the town and its success and its naming of being the coolest small town in America, we have Mayor G. Williams. And welcome to the program first.
Hey, good morning, Daniel.
By the way, the first thing I needed to get out of the way is the pronunciation of your town's name.
Oh, listen, it is pronounced in three ways.
Okay.
Right? It was originally named was a plantation, mm-hmm. right? Back in the 17th century, very successful traditional plantation, and it was called the Burley Plantation. Now, the Burley Inn was the place where all the drummers and all the people who brought supplies, because there was no Home Depot, there wasn't even a local hardware store, so everything that the plantation needed to be brought to the premises. So the Burley Inn was a very popular inn. It was very apparently, it was just right for its time, and people, when they were making their travels up and down, primarily from Philadelphia, where most of the goods came from, that was one of their favorite places to stop. So, over time, Burley Inn, because you know how Eastern Shoremen have been noted to have an accent.
Right.
Well, I think the accent might have been even greater back then. It kind of slurred together into, instead of Burley Inn, Berlin. And so for over 100 and some years, most people called it Berlin. But then came along World War II. And the other Berlin, which is now a sister community of ours over there in Germany, that pronunciation of Berlin just dominated. So you could tell a longtime resident from a younger generation resident back then by those two pronunciations. But now, as of 2011, we have our first craft brewery, the Burley Oak Brewery, and now many of the younger generation call us Berlin. So we don't care how you say it, Berlin, or Berlin, that's fine with us as long as you say it with friendship and affection.
Okay.
You can't go wrong.
Well, first of all, were you surprised that you got the coolest small town?
Yes, it was an unexpected pleasure. That's kind of the way I decided to describe to the community, to people, if they're coming to Berlin for the first time. We were very pleased to be among the final 15. We thought, hey, this is really great. And then all of a sudden, we realized that we were getting support way beyond anything we can imagine. And I think what has made this particularly gratifying is, yes, certainly the local residents got behind it, but the reason we were able to get this distinction is because of the support we got way beyond our borders. I mean, all throughout the Eastern Shore, all throughout the state of Maryland, and really, we had votes from all over the country. We didn't know so many people even knew who we are, who we are. So, we're very, very gratified and feel like this has been something that's taken generations to accomplish. It didn't happen overnight.
So what aspects do you think of your town really pushed you to the top in terms of what they were looking for?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Many of the reporters commented to me and different shows and things when they came to town. They were expecting everyone to talk about the physical aspects of Berlin. You know, the ambiance, the buildings, the historic nature and image. But what people talked about and what they got out of it was the attitude, the sense of cooperation, the sense of optimism, and the sense that we're actually in this together. And I'm telling you, that has been the big change from our, what I call, near-death experience back in the 60s and 70s, like most small towns. We were thriving up until the Depression, and then the Depression came along and it brought us down to our knees. And it took almost three quarters of a century to get back up. You know, a lot of people took part of that. A lot of people took risk in small businesses, but basically the businesses were moving to the larger cities and to the malls, and the small town experience was disappearing. And in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, there were more businesses that were closed and boarded up on Main Street than were open. And that was a wake-up call for everyone. You know, we said, what's wrong? And so fortunately, they put out the word, you know, let's just have a general discussion community meeting, nothing real formal. And somebody came up with the idea that they had heard that Frederick, Maryland, had started a revitalization program there about 5 years earlier. So we contacted them. They were very gracious. They sent down a team of folks, you know, maybe four or five folks. And they brought with them the older folks like myself will remember it. The before PowerPoint, there right. was the old carousel slide.
Oh, yes, right, the slide.
Well, they brought down a couple of carousels and put up a screen and basically showed all these older buildings in their town, all these nice public places that have been allowed to either become run down or have been covered over in formstone. Or do you remember maybe the movie Tin Men?
Right.
There were more buildings in Berlin covered up with so-called 21st century or 20th century architecture that basically ruined our whole look. So what they were doing was stripping everything back down to the originals, but doing it in a quality way. And they said, this won't happen overnight, but it immediately clicked. I mean, I was a newspaper man for the town at the time, so I followed this process right along. And the whole revival, we called it the revitalization period. We've been in revitalization since about 1980, and we feel in the last 5 years we've now transcended into what we call the Renaissance. And that revitalization was built on the premise of rediscovering and rehabilitating our architectural heritage. And that gives the experience I think most people find, especially on their first visit to Berlin, or if they haven't been back for a while, is you walk down Main Street and side streets, and you think you've gone back in time 100 years. But it's a 21st century community in every other way. So we do not see that as being in conflict. We see that being very complementary. We have, you know, one of the very simple things is we have downtown Wi-Fi. You know, where people meet for lunch and their businesses. I've never seen anybody who's doing business anymore without some sort of digital device.
Yes,
whether it's
a
personal digital device, a desktop, or now more commonly a tablet. But in any case, we thought that's one more thing we can do to say to people, well, let's meet in Berlin. And the overall attitude, another key thing is, again, people were not just talking about the physical attractiveness, because we worked very hard on that. To give you an example, while the buildings have been restored, and in some cases I suspect they look even better than they did 100 years ago because of the technology and the investments have been made, that at the same time, the attitude of the merchants and of the people who work there has been one of let's support each other.
Let me ask you about that, because in Salisbury, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about streetscaping, about changing, a lot of discussions about the plaza and whether to open it to traffic, not open to traffic. Lots of discussions about mm-hmm. that architectural element. But I guess that one of the questions I have for any city is, architecture is one thing, but how do you get businesses to come? You know, as a government, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to put a Penny's in here, I want to put this or that. Yeah. I mean, you've got to somehow try. How do you generate, and how did you generate that? Because you were saying just a moment ago that you had a majority of places that were closed. How do you go from that? I mean, how do you get business people in those places that's been boarded up to say, this is going to be an attractive, but you just wait. I mean, how did you do it?
Because people, when they come to a small town, they don't just come for the goods and the services, they come for the experience. And hopefully, Salisbury, no matter, Every town here, I think, on the Eastern Shore takes the attitude that they want to maintain their small town ambiance. The future is unlimited. And I'll give you a basic example. You know, the architecture itself alone, the redesign of parks, the physical setting is not going to do it alone. It is a change in the attitude about why you exist and why you are a community and what kind of community you want to be. And in our case, we decided that, you know, we had a, again, 30 some years later, we had a meeting about 5 years ago. We mm-hmm. just very informal, called most of the business people and anybody else who had an interest and just, you know, had an open discussion. And I said, I think we're starting to slip a little bit. We're starting to see a couple places, you know, that are taking a while to re-rent. And let's see if we can't revitalize. Well, this was ironically the summer of 2008, just before the economy decided to take a vacation, right?
Right.
And I have to be polite. So what we did is we talked about. I said, look, you all are very good competitors. You're good business people. You're making it in a small town in relatively, you know, with a lot of competition all around. I said, nobody here needs to have any more lessons on how to compete. What I want you to concentrate on is how can we cooperate and help each other. And so we had the discussion. We talked about it. I said, stop worrying about if the business next door has made $25 more than you did today or $100 more today or had one of their best days ever. Celebrate that fact and see it as part of your success as well. So by the end of that day, and then we have follow-up meetings that never stopped, we had every business basically say, commit to being a concierge for every other business in town. And I said, no. And he did. I mean, there were a handful that didn't buy into the idea, but they're not there anymore. I'll be honest with you. Hmm. They're long gone. But everybody else, I said, look, I've just got some great news for you. You just added almost 40 people to your business, and you don't have to pay them a dime. And it works. And I'll give you the story that is most memorable, because I've had many people tell me that they've come to Berlin and they couldn't find something, and instead of saying, well, thank you very much, they say, why don't you try so-and-so? Tell Sue or tell John or tell that I sent you and that this is what you're looking for, and they'll take care of you. It works. And I'll give you the story that is kind of shows this and frameworks this in the most memorable way, was when they made Ping Pong Summer over in Ocean City.
Mm-hmm.
In Ocean City, you know, we work with lots of partners. And Susan Sarandon, it was the star.
Right.
And as I didn't know this, but even though we'd had Tuck Everlasting and we'd had
right.
Runaway Bride in Berlin, it is apparently the tradition of the star to buy gifts for the crew. And everybody from the key grip person to who knows what all. Yeah, they have lots of people it takes to make a movie. So they try to buy them something personal, you know. So she had a list made up, and I don't know who this person was, but it just shows you, again, this idea of supporting each other. She asked someone in Ocean City, and they said, well, you could spend a lot of time, and you'll get maybe you'll get some of those things here, but this is a beach resort. But there's a town right next door that I think you'll find everything on your list, and it'll be neat, and it'll be unique. So she came on over. The first door she walked into is a very artsy personal and home decor and so forth called Tada. Just by chance, although she had this wonderful list, and Tada is a very popular place on Main Street, there was nothing on that list that was just precise to that store. So the owner says, don't you worry about it, honey. She told her daughter, you watch the register. I'm going to take Susan, and we're going to go up and down the street and go where we got to go until we get this list filled. And that is Berlin. She couldn't believe it. She had never had that kind of treatment before, ever. And you don't have to be a movie star to be treated like that when you come to Berlin. So it's a matter of sharing in the success of the community, looking out for each other. I know these things are so basic, but they've been forgotten.
Did you in the conversion
that is out of the 70s into or in the 80s into where you are now. Was there like a tipping point in downtown where suddenly you got some momentum, that you got enough people to come in to have stores, that then, I mean, was there?
We had to go through it. The tipping point, I think, was when we went from a community of skeptics to a community of believers. And I'll give you a very quick example, because this story has been told many times, and I witnessed it. As again, I was kind of the fortunate to be, as a local newspaper man and editor, is to watch all this happen and report it as it was happening. And two men, the late Jim Barrett, who had Barrett Chevrolet and Olds at the time, and now it's Barrett Chevrolet Jeep, I believe. And then there was Bill Freeman, who owned the local jewelry store, bought an older building that was run down, and they called it, it's interesting enough, Renaissance Plaza. And they made all the downtown, all the downstairs parts, small shops, but very nice, and turned the upstairs, which had always been storage, into nice apartments. Hmm. And of course, people literally will walk, they called it Barrett's Folly. Mm-hmm. They said, nobody puts money in Berlin. You guys, you know, I hope you enjoyed your money while you had it. And it took on sort of a humorous kind of ridicule, but not mean. But people thought, this is silly. Within 6 months of them opening that revitalized building, every store was filled with brand new stores we never had before, and every apartment had been leased. Suddenly, within months, a group of 13 families got together and put up, initially, the figure that we do know is that initially the 13 families put up $100,000 each to buy and revitalize what is now known, very well known, as the Atlantic Hotel.
Right.
At that time, you couldn't even hardly see it from the front street, because in the 40s, it was so run down that they literally built a building in front of it to hide it. Yes. And it served its purpose as a jewelry store and a little cafe, you know. But basically, here we had a jewel that was hidden. So these folks took the money to tear down the building and start restoring it, and they made the commitment to restore it to historic trust standards. So this is private investment. And the irony is, and part of the legend, is that about a year into the project, they had to have a second meeting and say, folks, we've either got to write that money, kiss it goodbye, or put up another significant ante. And 100% of them said, let's not give up. And when that opened, that was the tipping point. It suddenly, the community could see, wow, look how beautiful this is, the Renaissance Plaza down here. And you could tell all these other buildings on Main Street, they had been temporarily masked by the 20th century. The 20th century, the best thing it probably did for Berlin was to pass us by. We didn't tear down a lot, so we didn't lose a lot. And so we're very fortunate about that. But the other aspect of that was that the town and the mayor, and this goes back multiple administrations and lots of different council people in the community, then removed all the utility lines from Main Street and put in, we didn't go underground because we didn't have the money. So we just fed all the buildings from Main Street with electric standpoint and all other services from the rear, and then put in Victorian streetlights and other various attributes of that era, and just it just naturally from then gradually but steadily built on itself. Success breeds success.
Now, one of the things that is different about Berlin as opposed to, say, Salisbury, is that in Salisbury, for better or for worse, there was a whole series of decisions that were made that created these highways, like, for instance, Highway 50, which basically cut the town in half and really separated a major residential area from what was then downtown. I mean, so that you have to walk across a very busy place, and psychologically, it's also separating. Yes. In addition to that,
we call it. We have a similar situation, not quite as severe. It's called US 113.
Yes, right.
Exactly. We call it the Berlin Wall. and since they got rid, and we're working on that with the State Highway Administration. They when that was first put in the late 50s.
Right.
Nobody could conceive of Berlin. You know, at that time we had less than 2,000 people. Now we have 4,500. Nobody foresaw people wanting to be get out and walk as much as possible. Bicycling is extremely popular. People would prefer to walk if where it's safe and appropriate to do so. So right now, the corridor of right. 113, the State Highway Administration, working with a citizens committee that we put together of concerned citizens, is going to be putting in over time and starting with one particular intersection, a pedestrian crosswalk, signage that lets people know that you're entering into a town, and lowering the speed limit. And some of these things have already been done in Salisbury. There's the countdown crosswalk there by the government building and so forth. But I think that it takes the entire community attitude that you are now in a town. You're not in what used to be the major thoroughfare to right. get to Ocean City get back home.
Because I was wondering about, because I mean, even as I look at the town, as soon as you leave downtown, you ease right into what are essentially residential areas. Mm-hmm. And a place like Salisbury, that doesn't really happen. And you have a sort of naturally organic place. Whereas I know with the mayor's proposals that is for Salisbury is to try to sort of create this economic ecosystem of having both heads and beds, so that there would be some residential stuff or places. Is that kind of thing enough, or do you think you need something that's really organic?
Well, I think it's a good place to start.
Okay,
I honestly do, and I think that. Because of the scale of Salisbury, that I would say start at the core,
right?
Just like you would if you were in bad health, and Salisbury is not in bad health. It just needs some reinvigorating, in my opinion. It's got so much potential, right. But you'd start with the heart, right? Make sure your heart's in good shape before you start exercising, and I think that's the approach that apparently is being considered. And the other thing is, from an Eastern Shore point of view, our largest city.
Right? That's true.
It's a big town or a small city, but either way, it's I would think that if you start with the heart and then concentrate by neighborhoods, where the people in the neighborhoods are interested in revitalization, support them. And those that, you know, want to hang back, well, you know, you can't do it all at once anyway. And then I do think that based on our experience, success breeds success. And, you know, there is no neighborhood in Berlin that has not been revitalized over the last 30-some years, regardless of what kind of economic circumstances they were started in. And again, it's because people wanted it. But they have to be involved. This is one thing I think is key, is that, and on a grander scale, I think it's true for the whole country, but it can be more easily shown to have results, is citizens cannot delegate the responsibilities as citizens. That is the one difference in Berlin. We have so many volunteers. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. People ask me, yeah, and especially from outside when I'm, you know, giving more talks than ever.
Right.
And they say, who are the most important people in Berlin? Who is making Berlin successful? And I say, well, normally you would think it would be the people with the most financial means, and normally we think it would be the people with the most political influence. I said, they're very supportive and they're very helpful and they do their part. I said, but the most important people in Berlin are volunteers and they don't get paid a dime. We literally have hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. We have, I think now we have 20 major events.
Right.
We have another 10 Second Friday art strolls, and now we're getting ready to have our next Saturday, the 29th of March, a special celebration to have what we call America's Coolest Party.
That's right.
And we're going to try, rain or shine.
Right.
You know, the weather is not going to determine the outcome, but the attitude will. And that's why I'm so optimistic, regardless of if it's a little damp, if it's a little cool, it won't matter. And I think that idea that citizens get involved, it doesn't mean that everybody's supposed to be running for election. You only need a handful of people to make decisions about how the limited resources of government are spent.
Right.
But you need hundreds of people to make the whole system work.
Now the town's about 4,500, I think.
Yes, 4,500.
Now, is that? Have you seen major growth? I mean, is that
major growth? What has happened is when I came back from University of Maryland College Park and graduated in 71, after growing up in Berlin, we just barely had 2,000 people.
Okay.
It had grown to 3,000 over about, I guess it was from 1970 to 2000. So in 30 years, it went from just barely 2,000 to 3,000. Mm-hmm. But from 2000 to 2010, it grew by 1,500. So we basically added 50%. But we added people who came there, as I'll say, they came there to live, not to die. And that's a very important aspect of it. People of all ages are welcome in our community as long as they're young at heart. If you're an old fuddy-dud and you don't want anything going on in your neighborhood, you don't want to see people having fun, you don't want to see young people out and about, you don't want to be involved in your community, you will not like Berlin.
But if you
really want to get involved and get up every morning with something to live for, yeah, we're a good place.
Do you think, so you have 4,500 people, and we'll see as growth goes on just whether it becomes unwieldy. As opposed to, say, a town like, for instance, like Salisbury's got around 30,000, I guess, now.
Yes, many times bigger.
I mean, do you think it's easier in a small town with that kind of small population, if you have all the right elements, obviously, as opposed to something that's larger?
I would have to say, in all frankness, it's probably easier to get started because, like any major project, I learned this in business or in the nonprofit world or in government world. Sometimes it's easier to start with something small where you haven't sold the farm, so to speak, and work it out. And if you make mistakes, they're not terminal.
Right.
And they're also not so costly that you can't repair them, make the situation better, and then go to the next level. And I suggest that not that I feel that I have any particular expertise about Salisbury, but certainly I think there's certain things that we have in common. And one is, first, the community has to have a very, very open, very sincere, and very optimistic conversation about what is the vision for Salisbury in the future. It has so daggone much potential. But what is missing is the vision of the people themselves. And that's where, there's a young generation out there that's got so much energy, excitement, and there's so many people who want to live here. They want to live here on Delmarva. Some want to live in a bigger town like Salisbury. Others want to live in a smaller town. And what we have the advantage here that if somebody wants the quiet country life, there are wonderful little communities within our grasp where you can live that kind of life but still go for an evening out or spend a weekend at a festival in a variety of communities, everything from a beach resort in Ocean City to the happy small town of Berlin, to Salisbury with all its great diversity, such as the zoo and the ballpark and so many other things. And I think Salisbury is just a matter of folks got to leave. They got to leave the past to past. We have many ways that we brand Berlin, but one of them is we say we honor our past, but we don't live in it. And that is a very important attitude. We are proud to be a 21st century community. We are very proud of the diversity of our community, and as long as you're not annoying anybody, as long as you're not breaking the law, you can come to town and enjoy yourself, because we will tolerate almost everything except intolerance, and it makes all the difference.
We were speaking with G. Williams. He is mayor of the town of Berlin, and we should mention that the town has been named America's coolest small town. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I know it's been a lot of work.
Unexpected.
Next up, we're going to be talking with a Daily Times reporter about the future of Salisbury and the Vision series that the paper has now been conducting, and believe, as a matter of fact, the series should begin next week. This is Delmarva Day. I'm Don Rush, and we'll be back in a moment.
Are Our human ancestors hunted and gathered. They survived and reproduced. And one day, they began to ask, why? I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives. A journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
It's called Coming Together, What is Salisbury? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Salisbury Daily Times is about to begin a series on the future of Salisbury. Over the past 10 years, there's been a great debate and a great deal of acrimony over what has been called the crossroads of Delmarva. It's a town that has seen substantial growth, with now around 30,000 residents, has been experiencing the pains and conflicts that come with it. In our studio is Jeremy Cox. He's a staff writer for the paper who has been deeply involved in the project. And welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first of all, give me a sense about how the idea for this project began. How did you get the idea, and did folks get the idea that this was something that you wanted to pursue?
It really originated with our editor, Mike Killian, as a veteran newspaper man. Comes from a background of civic journalism in his career. Civic journalism, of course, being really searching for community voices to tell the story, as opposed to let's talk to the powers that be and that sort of thing. So it's really kind of a bottom-up telling of where we are, what we're doing, how do we get to where we want to go, the planning year more or less being 2025. And we break that down into particular topics like downtown, quality of life, what is there to do around here. Really Mike was the genesis of that.
So what kinds of areas then are you exploring, first of all?
Mm-hmm. Downtown revitalization and development, quality of life, crime, of course. We had a meeting last week in Doverdale to get public opinion about that. And as I said, quality of life, which is kind of like a umbrella, kind of a catch-all term, but really encompasses the arts, social scene, cohesion, and also we're looking at leadership. You know, who historically has had the power in this town, who hasn't had the power. Of course, in Salisbury, being where we are, race plays a large role in that. So we're exploring that topic as well.
So what sense do you get in terms of the city about where it is at the moment? I mean, what are people telling you about how they feel about where they are? And obviously, we've gone through fairly tumultuous times, certainly within the city council and city, mm-hmm. and city politics. What are people telling you?
Well, for me, it boils down to, if you're into, you know, catchy catchphrases, the crossroads of Delmarva, as you call it, is at a crossroads. It's sort of standing there. It has different paths it can take. It's a metaphor I'm using anyway for my story. And right now, you're starting to see it edge forward a little bit, trying to choose a path forward. We see that with the election last April, of re-election of Jim Ireton, of course, and Jake Day joining the council as the council president. And that brought with it sort of a new energy where Mr. Ireton had difficulty in the past working with the council, the council majority as it was then. Now you're seeing that ice thaw. The two campaigned together, so this is no surprise. But and they've pushed through a number of initiatives aimed at really, really strong in downtown. If you were there at the State of the City address recently, downtown probably took up half of that hour-long address. A lot of it was just listing number of restaurants that are coming down there.
Right.
But you're really seeing maybe a lot of people are saying a new energy that wasn't there before. And talking to one developer, he said that, you know, it's not like they went in and you know, okay, we're going to streamline the permitting process or whatever, but there's just a new energy downtown. Like, people aren't afraid to, you know, handle your permit for fear that they might lose their jobs.
Well, one of the things about the proposals that we're seeing now, we're talking about selling off some of the parking lots. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be much, much different than what the kind of discussions we've had in the past. In the past, we've had perhaps what I might call sort of the cosmetic approach, where we have streetscapes, we've had ideas about whether we should open or close, for instance, the one portion of the downtown street, the plaza, as it were. There's been a lot of that discussion, and obviously there's an enterprise zone. Well, what I think seems to be significant here is the whole idea that they may be selling off parking lots and actually putting back, as it were, businesses as well as some residences where once there were businesses. Because if you look, for instance, the old photographs, you see those parking lots were once filled with stores. That's where people like shopped. It seems to me that is probably the major shift, at least when I look at this over the last 10 years. Then do you get that sense as well that's a certain impetus that's much different than it was before?
Yeah. Now, this was proposed by the mayor back in, I believe, 2010, 2011 maybe. To sell off the parking lots. And here's the thing. The parking lots were apparently never supposed to be in perpetuity, that once this was a 1960s era, many cities went through this. My previous town, Jacksonville, went through this, where, okay, let's tear down these old dilapidated buildings that we would probably love to have today, and we'll make parking, surface street parking. But apparently here, the idea was, that parking is temporary until we can find a higher and better use for it. But over time, it just sort of became ingrained that, well, we have parking here. I can just walk straight into the store or what have you. And now it's something that people, you know, are, as we've heard from some of the stakeholders downtown, they will certainly miss once it's gone. And so you're hearing that component of it. As far as the downtown parking lots go, and this is coming from the guy who's handling the downtown component of the story. It's interesting because we have this, he hesitates to even call it a plan, but a report that the mayor put out, as I said, in 2011. But it's not really a plan per se that lays out objectives and goals and here's how we're going to do it. For all the plans that you kind of discussed there that we've had through the years, they're not really working from, you know, any sort of guide right now. I mean, there's the comp plan, but that's hardly if ever referenced. I never hear about it, and I go to just about every meeting. But they're kind of, and you'll hear this from people out there, like, well, you know, we want to do this, but, you know, we're a little leery about jumping into something when you don't really know where you're going. And that might be a possible obstacle to further development if developers continue having this feeling.
No, one of the concepts, as I understand it, I talked to the mayor a few weeks ago, was this idea that this was not just going to be shopping, but there's stores, but he clearly wants some kind of residential component to that, trying to compare it. And I know that there has been efforts in the past, for instance, to have just simply some residential components, which then those residential developments came really sort of right as the housing market just collapsed. So, I mean, you had these homes, these condos that were selling for a few hundred thousand dollars, and suddenly they weren't worth as much. Mm-hmm. How realistic is it to have that kind of mixed component? Because the sense I got from the mayor was he's got this idea that people who live down there, well, okay, well, then it'll become a sort of an economic ecosystem where they live down there and then they go to these shops that'll take care of them, as opposed to, say, running up to the northern part of the town where you have the big boxes. I mean, from your experience and what you've seen and you've looked at these kinds of plans, is this concept working? I mean, has that been tried before?
Yeah, heads in beds, he calls it,
exactly.
is what we're missing, right? You know, I don't think he's wrong there. I mean, we do have neighborhoods that surround the area, but the problem right now is that there's obstacles everywhere you go. So you have Newtown to the north, and you have to cross Business Route 50. You've got the Lake Street area and down Fitzwater, but again, you've got the river there, and you have to go over a bridge. And to the south, you have the East Prong that divides from the university area. And when it comes to walkability, and of course 13 on the east side, when it comes to walkability, these are a big deal, right? I mean, if you tried to cross 13 or walk it, you're alive, so I'm assuming no. Right. What will be right now, we are seeing a resurgence in a particular kind of housing in Salisbury.
Mm-hmm.
Apartments.
Right.
I can no longer count the number of large apartment complexes on one hand that are not just in the pipeline, but that are being built right now. Okay. And that's in response to the growth at Salisbury University. But where are these apartment complexes? They're in the university area, as they should be, the University Orchard. But they're also over on Bigland Park Drive with Ocean Isles, or they're up, as you said, in the North District, about by Target, with Addison Court, or in other places. They're not happening downtown, with one notable exception, and that's River's Edge, as you know, supposedly going to be an arts community. But that's on the other side of the river, and the hope is that that will give you some of that critical mass that's necessary for things to survive downtown. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, when you see these new, you know, pop out of the ground mixed use developments in better off places, they always have like a drugstore or little grocery stores, and those are definitely missing downtown because obviously, you know, business owners are looking at it saying, no one's going to want to come here, you know, walk downstairs. I don't have enough people. And when you see that happen, that's probably when, you know, we can say, all right, Salisbury downtown is happening now.
Because, I mean, it seems to me that what he's trying to do is, and we're talking about the heads and beds, is to try to get both of those elements in at exactly the same time, because it doesn't work mm-hmm. one without the other. I mean, if you don't have the shopping area, then you may not buy something downtown, you know, to live in. And on the other hand, if you've got a business to sell, you're probably not going to move into a business to sell unless you got some kind of heads, some kind of beds out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems as if he's trying to do both at the same time.
Yeah. And that's and taking a step further back, I was talking to Ed Miller is the director of the Center for the Small City up at University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Go whatever their mascot is. And he says, you know, in his experience, the hardest thing about redevelopment is that first step. It's getting that momentum and getting what they call it's called conglomeration or agglomeration. Mm-hmm. You know, normally I'm writing and I can just Google that term. But the idea is kind of like a Silicon Valley is a big example, right? You know, you get something like, a Google or a Microsoft or Apple in an area. And then others come and, oh, you know, there's this happening here and I'll produce your microchips or I'll do the software. And so getting that first thing is critical. Maybe you want to talk about the med school, because I think that a lot of people, that's what they hope it will be.
Because one of the things, that struck me, and I've talked about this many times, I remember doing a piece a few years ago, and there was a city planner, and he says, you know, if you spread out a map of the Salisbury Mall, the center at Salisbury, and you overlay it in downtown, you can see immediately that the mall is actually much larger than downtown, even with the parking stuff. And so the question becomes, why would you go to, say, the Salisbury Mall as opposed to, say, for instance, downtown? And one of the answers is, even though there's a bigger space, the fact of the matter is that the mall itself is designed to be attractive. It's designed to be comfortable. It's designed, where as opposed to downtown, the way it's cut up, as you point out, doesn't really make it that way. I mean, I remember talking to one person who said, you know, they created Route 50 because they thought, oh, well, people will turn off of Route 50 and go to downtown. Well, they didn't. They just sort of bypassed it. In the process, they built a gigantic road that, as you say, separated one part of the city from the next. Is it possible to create that kind of intimacy with that kind of terrain? I think that's one of the mm-hmm. questions they're going to be facing.
Right. So, interesting about downtown is when you add up all the square footage, it's something like 600,000 square feet. Three Walmart super centers. Mm-hmm. That's a tremendous amount of space. Now, some of that is, you know, residential upstairs. But I don't think people realize just how much space and what you can do with it. So you kind of have the beginning there of possibly an outdoor mall kind of a feel there, and especially on the plaza. And the city is looking to expand on that with some improvements that are needed for, you know, stormwater anyway, from Division Street down to 13. as part of that, they'll include some streetscaping that will make that road a little narrower than what it is now, a little bit more akin to what you see there in the plaza. And actually, they'll expand the plaza out a little bit, so it's not quite so so tight. So you'll still have traffic downtown, but the idea is to slow it down, make it feel a little bit cozier, and hopefully entice people to, you know, think of this as your alternative to the mall, you know, just, you know, breathing air as opposed to air conditioning.
Right. So now one of the key issues that has been here for a long time has been the whole issue about rentals as opposed to homeownership. And if you look up, for instance, when you look at something like Camden, if you drive up Camden, you can see where there are single-family homes that have been turned into essentially apartments where multiple people. And the way, by the way, you can see that is if you drive by and you see one mailbox, you know it's a single family. If, on the other hand, they've got four mailboxes, you know that there are like four people that are renting there. Is there any sense about how to deal with that controversy? Because we had 4-2, which was to limit the number of unrelated people into a rental.
Right.
And that obviously expanded it to 4-3. Is there any concern about that, or how are they dealing with that? Do you have any sense about that?
Sure. We find ourselves, I think, at a quiet but interesting moment in that that particular front. You know, you'll recall a few years ago that this was a very hot issue. A lot of you know, angry letters to the editor going back and forth from the Salisbury Area Property Owners Association and the City Council about enforcing the rental ordinance. The two people unrelated and that sort of thing, and having, you know, inspectors come to your house and demand to come inside. And as we know, that kind of got circumvented by, well, you know, human nature. The tenant said, I don't think I want to let you in. Sometimes at, you know, the urging of their landlords. And, you know, the inspectors really weren't able to get a lot done on that end. Now, talking to Tom Stevenson, who was the head of neighborhood services, now the city administrator, says that, you know, we did get a lot done, though, that we did a lot of we were still able to look at the outside of places, and people that maybe turned us away realized that we were here, and we got calls later on, you know, saying, look, you know, I didn't really realize that I had this power to, you know, that the law is in place that could help me with this difficult landlord situation I'm having. But ever since then, they no longer do the patrols that quietly kind of went away about a year and a half ago. You don't hear anything out of the Property Owners Association. I think the one way that it's manifesting itself right now, and we may be have found a solution for better or for worse, is the house parties. Particularly during War on the Shore. And this also is tied into downtown, if I may go back to that, because you're a student here. What do you do for fun? Okay, you've got a Monkey Barrel across the street. You've got Brew River on Thursdays. Okay, that's two nights a week. But this, hey, I'm in college. Yes, not that's enough, okay? Maybe I don't want to go there every day. So what they end up doing is having, you know, parties at someone's place, and when that really manifests itself is during War on the Shore weekend, and the last two or three years now we've experienced, you know, the maybe a little people having too much of a good time, and the police having to come out and pepper spray, and it's bad public relations, it's bad town gown relations, and so what did they do this year? Well, it was on Tuesday. During spring break. So, yay, school spirit.
That's right. And most people are gone.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
So maybe we've reached kind of a bit of a truce on that front, but I suspect temporarily. And it may be, you know, the market may be responding as well. All these apartments that I've been listing, trying to encourage students to, okay, come in. We got this corporate system. You get your own lease. You know, we have superintendents, you got Wi-Fi, the amenities are better, it's cost is fairly comparable. So, you know, I think that will help kind of ease that market there, maybe, you know, give less incentive for these owners to do, as you're saying, carve things up and charge $500 a head per month and, you know, sewer system be darned.
Right. Because I know there's a lot of pressure because when the market was doing very well in terms of the housing market,
right,
with the values, it really paid to go ahead and own these things and rent them out. Yeah.
I saw an ad the other day, $2,000 a month for one of the grandfathered units. We have, scores of those. $2,000, that's a mortgage payment and then some.
Right.
I mean, I can't blame them. It's a good investment. So really, it's funny how the market forces might just, prevail where a government solution, if you will, had some impact, but didn't necessarily solve it.
Right. What do you sense by, you alluded to this before, what sense do you get about one of the dynamics that I've seen over the last 10 years, which is sort of the dynamics of personality, which is often driven by interests? For instance, we saw a lot of that coming out of the 4-2 conflict. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and this is sort of one of the pieces of the irony, is that some of the folks who had the most problems with the mayor had most problems with, were initially his allies. I mean, people like Debbie Campbell obviously lost her race, but also Terry Cohen, for example, where the mayor has clearly expressed that he has had problems with him. And yet, I remember on election night when he got elected, when they were in the majority, it looked as if it was going to be smooth sailing. What sense do you get about what went wrong here? I mean, they all were on the same page.
Yeah. Gosh. It was one of those things where I think the mayor is an ambitious guy, right? I think he drinks a lot of caffeine. And he likes to get things done. He wants it done now. He'll yell out his door to get, his assistant to grab him something in the middle of a conversation. I mean, he's just – that's his metabolism is a lot higher than a lot of people's around here. So when he wasn't moving as quickly on the things that he wanted to do, he got frustrated, and his reaction was to, you're either with me or you're against me on this, and that rubbed people, perhaps understandably, the wrong way, the Terry Cohens and Debbie Campbells of the world, and you saw that relationship really deteriorate fast. And where they even saw eye to eye on things, it was almost like, they would find a way to disagree. So you've seen maybe a little bit of a different tone coming lately since April, where, in the State of the City address, the mayor was careful to give credit to not just the city council in general, but to, name Terry Cohen for certain things that she's helped vote for and pass, and also to champion in some cases the raises for the police department, for example, where he kind of went out of his way not to do that in the past. Now, will this continue? Who knows? I'm not one to say that. I doubt it, but given that very fiery personality that he has. I wouldn't be surprised if it was reignited over one issue or another. But, just as someone, I'd rather write about issues than write about, people being upset at each other. So it's been nice for me,
I mean, because it does seem to me that there are two dynamics, and I think I mentioned this to your editor. One has been just simply the stresses and strains of growth, which we've seen, which creates a certain amount of conflicts in which old neighborhoods are then affected by changes in the roadways, Route 50 and so on. And Isabella Street, for example, is probably a good example of how it used to be a quiet road, and then suddenly people were using it and to get from one side of the city and to the other, and then suddenly the old neighborhood wasn't so quiet anymore. So you get these stress and strains. So you get this pain that comes. But at the same time, it also seemed to be compounded with a whole set of personalities and personal histories, and those seem to be combined to sort of create this real sort of mishigas, as it were, of conflict.
Nice word.
So let me ask you this. So in terms of crime, because I know you guys were out there with Stop the Violence, tell me a little bit about what you guys have found so far.
Well, what you're saying, it's Salisbury has a good story to tell. I mean, it really does. that the crime is part one crimes, which is the most serious crimes we're talking about, you know, homicide, aggravated assault, that sort of thing, sexual assault, are at the lowest point in more than 10 years. 2006 was the peak year, something like over 3,000 part one crimes at that time. Now we're just at 2,096, I believe, was the number for 2013. The police chief, Barbara Duncan, would like to see it below 2,000. So if she were sitting here, right, she'd be kind of setting her jaw a little bit. But I think any outside observer would say that's impressive. What's even more impressive about it is it's not like there was some sort of flight away from the city and or what have you. I mean, the city continued to grow over that time. You know, several thousand more residents. We're nearing 31,000. So, you know, anytime you have population growth, it's just sort of standard to go, okay, well, crime will go up. Well, in fact, it did quite the opposite. Mayor has a compelling argument about that, and that is, you know, one of the reasons that we saw the spike in crime in 2000s was all of the deindustrialization that preceded it in the 80s and the 90s, the loss of your Dresser Wayne's, your Campbell Soup's, and other employers, Crown, Cork, and Seal, sort of the center could no longer hold. People lost their way. So the undesirable elements, you know, found their purchase here in Salisbury. And now, you know, perhaps with certainly stepped up police, patrols, things like the Safe Streets program, which puts more of an emphasis on neighborhood policing. They've gone back out and established a couple of substations. But, you know, it's also an economic thing. So, yeah, our economy, it got better there for a while with the construction and the building industry. And so now, you know, with our economy contracting last year by 1.4% within the metropolitan area and predicted, unfortunately, to contract again by one of the steepest drops in the country this year, if the mayor's right, there might be grounds for concern about some backsliding there.
Is there a sense, any, by the way, as to how they've been able to deal with the presence of gangs? I know that a few years ago there was a great deal of concern about that and producing some of the violence. I mean, have they got a handle on that thing, or what are they saying at this point?
Yeah, so you're kind of an innovative tack taken by Chief Duncan on that, where it's a lot of, you know, kids just with nothing better to do. So kids who could be shunted into the, you know, the juvenile system and, you know, graduate then to the adult system, and this cycle that we've seen. So, you know, this past summer, where she concentrated on the Doverdale community and rounded up some young people, juveniles, she'd call them, who, you know, they could arrest at that moment based on the evidence that she and the state attorney's office had compiled. And instead of, okay, we're going to arrest you, giving them the option, okay, this is what we've got on you. Wouldn't it be better to do these other things instead? You know, do this program and, you know, follow this course of action and give them things to do. And just about all of them did that, by the way. I mean, people are not stupid. So you're seeing some action about that. And, you know, but it was almost like having the Band-Aid ripped off again when there was the rap video that came out that really was focused on Doverdale and, kind of the right. usual tropes of gangster rap. And that kind of... Perhaps something positive can come to that. And by the way, you know, for me, it's just kind of typical. There's probably, you know, 99% just guys acting, playing a character.
Right.
But it's really more the metaphor, what it represents, the symbolism there that I think kind of hit people, you know, and perhaps something positive will come out of that, where we'll see. And I think it's also one of the triggers for this series, why we wanted to focus on crime, was, you know, clearly not everyone is there's still that element here.
So what do you hope to come out, just briefly, what hope will you come out of this series and these meetings and so on? What's and where do you go from here outside of a nice series?
Hey, it's similar to, well, I don't need any sheet cake. You know, sheet cake journalism is the term, right? No, it's very much what you do, right? Okay. We're listening to the community. We want to hear what drives people here, and what are some of the things that can bring us, take us forward. So this is a little different than just the usual, you know, recitation of here's all the problems that we have. I think with each story, you'll find that we lay out not a roadmap, but at least some ideas that have worked elsewhere that, you know, can be, you know, worked with in some way here to, you know, make for a better future.
Well, we've been speaking with Jeremy Cox. He's a staff writer for the Salisbury Daily Times, and they're beginning a series looking at the future of Salisbury and what people have to say. It's called Coming Together, What is Salisbury? And I appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.